Despite a wet winter, bark beetles are still killing millions of California trees, increasing the threat of wildfire. Maintain 100 feet of defensible space around your home now by removing dead trees and vegetation. Learn more from Cal Fire at readyforwildfire.org.
Blog Talk Radio.
All our Wise Women Media Radio Show listeners, this is Anita Stewart with a special guest tonight, Lier Keith. First, before we get started, I wanted to thank our sponsors, Roundtree 7, Here Be Monsters, Daughters of Isis, The Hoodooed Blog, Power New Media and Public Relations, Tarot and Stars, and Florida Nature Photos. We also want to let people know that you can find us on our blog at wisewomenmedia.posteris.com. And if you want to donate to help keep the show on the air, we do have a WePay link at the top of the blog. Just click on that and dig deep, and any little amount will help us every week pay for Internet access. And hopefully I'll be getting a domain name soon to set up an actual website. So that will be next on the list. So let's go right to our interview. Lierre, you're with us?
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you how you liked that song or the message of that song. I thought it was kind of fitting for what we were going to be talking about tonight.
I thought it was really beautiful. I couldn't understand all the words, but it's definitely a very haunting, it's a haunting melody and a haunting refrain, so thanks for playing that.
Yeah, Michael Franti really gets the message across, and I encourage anybody that wants to actually see the official video, just go to YouTube and look up Michael Franti, Hey World, and the video, the images are really amazing, too, on that. So let's talk about Lierre and how, I think the question I asked you earlier when we were doing a pre-interview was, how did you get the fire in your belly to work on environmentalism, to become a radical feminist, to write incredible things in books like The Deep Green Resistance and The Vegetarian Myth, and fill us in on what were the catalyst things that got all that going for you?
Well, you know, sometimes people ask me that, and I have to flip it around and wonder, what is wrong with everybody else? I can't understand why other people aren't motivated. And my whole life, when I see injustice, it just burns me up. And I want to do whatever I can to make it stop. And that was true when I was a child. I didn't lose that when I was a teenager, like a lot of teenagers do. And certainly it's been true my whole adult life. So I just don't understand why other people can stand by while really incredibly horrible things are happening around them. You know, we have choices. We can be perpetrators, we can be bystanders, or we can be victims. And I like to introduce that fourth choice, which is we can intervene, we can be the people who stop it, because otherwise it just goes around in that circle, you know. But, you know, having said that, ever since I was a young child, I was very aware that there was just tremendous destruction going on across the planet. I've always been somebody who was an environmentalist, even before I had that word. I can remember being 4 or 5 years old and just being heartbroken, seeing things like oil refineries. And, you know, I grew up in Philadelphia, and we would drive up to see my grandmother in Connecticut, and it's just hell driving through New Jersey. It's just horrendous, you know, what this culture has done to what was once one of the most, lush and gorgeous places on Earth, and now it's just cement and pollution and, you know, you can still see the destroyed wetlands there just outside New York City, and there are still water birds trying to nest. I've seen wild geese in there, and it just will break your heart because it's so destroyed. So that, you know, always just struck me, and I wasn't somebody who could turn that off. I think most children feel that, but I think they learn to turn it off because it's too painful. And, you know, what is not spoken ends up just being suppressed in our psyches. And luckily I found language before that process began for me. So I always knew that this was wrong and that there were things I could do about it. And then I guess the other thing that really helped was my mom's a feminist. And she gave me a really good grounding in some basic feminist values. I can remember when I was 7 years old, she explained to my sister and me what was wrong with beauty pageants, you know. And I still remember what she said because it made so much sense. And she was very critical of things like war toys and explained why those were bad. And Barbie dolls, and like what did that teach us about women? And I got it, you know, that it wasn't a heavy sell. I understood her perspective. I could see what she meant. So those were lessons that I carried with me. And then she gave me really good books, too, when I was a teenager. She gave me some really radical feminist writers, and that was, I think, the thing that pushed me over, because I finally had a complete framework to understand the world as I was experiencing it. And I think at that age especially, a lot of girls just go underground because all these horrendous things are happening, and you're being socialized into just complete submission, and there's nothing helping you fight. And so I think a lot of girls just give up at that point and do the best they can. And I didn't, because I had these really wonderful books. I was reading Mary Daly and Andrea Dworkin and Susan Griffin, and that was it. It was, that was what let me survive. And you know, embrace my role as really a warrior for women. So I guess that's pretty much, from there it was easy. That was the hard part, you know, the first 18 years getting through public school and all the rest of that. But once I was on my own, of course, then you find friends and you find the movements and, you know, you're able to get involved.
So would you say most of that happened when you left public school and went on to college? Was that pretty much a blossoming time for you in the realm of activism?
I did not have that experience in college. I still was struggling to find other people who were as radical as I was, so I ended up dropping out. But once I left college and, you know, joined a pretty radical community in Western Massachusetts, that was a lot easier because then I was able to find others, and then everything got easier. It's really hard, you know, as a group of one to kind of hold your own against the weight of so much. There's just so much wrong with the culture, and so much of the knowledge is so horrifying that I think a lot of people back away. You know, they get so overwhelmed by the trauma of just learning about all the bad things. And I think it's a very understandable emotional reaction. You know, you hit overload. And there's even a concept in psychology about secondary trauma, which is it didn't happen to you, but just hearing it that it happened to other people can be really traumatizing. So learning about rape and battering and prostitution, and then, you know, opening up to all of world history, and you end up learning about, you know, one Holocaust after another, what's happened to indigenous people, what happened to African Americans on this continent, you know, on and on, all the different European invasions in Asia and Africa. And you just left one, like, why are we here? Was it really just a sadistic impulse of the cosmos? You know, you end up with these gigantic questions that are really go to the core of you and what stand you're going to take. You know, as a person who's going to be awake, you got to be strong. And having other people around you means the burden is borne by more than just one. You know, if you can find two, if you can find four, if you can find eight, by the time you get to 16, you feel almost invincible. And it's such a tiny little number, but when I got to that number of people, it was like we can take on the world. So for those of you who are feeling lonely or overwhelmed, you got to find others. It's the only way to survive this.
It's almost like you have to approach a critical mass to feel enough to keep going. And in this, in regards to feminism, I guess we can talk about that first. You know, it's just amazing that most of the women that I know are so cultured to the men. And the men become the important things in their life. And I'm not sure how old you are, but I'm in my 50s. So we're kind of like the baby boomer generation. And you know, my generation of women are really, we call ourselves liberated, but many of us are not. And unless we've had that exposure to the feminist teachings like you have, Mary Daly and all the rest. So I find there was an article, and I can't remember who did it, but I know Cynthia McKinney has mentioned it several times. It's called Women of the Hegemony. And mm-hmm. I thought, oh, my God, that's really true a lot of the times. The women are simply, they call themselves liberated, but they're really just trying to be very, very direct and forceful and assertive like men. There's really no difference, you know. Does that make sense?
It does, and it makes me think of Alan Johnson's work. He has a great book called The Gender Knot. He's a really great pro-feminist guy, and he defines patriarchy as there's three different aspects. It's male-defined, it's male-identified, and it's male-centered. And it's really hard as women to break through that. You know, we don't. It's hard to get any kind of social recognition that you exist as if you're female, because it's only men who get seen and only men who count, and we experience that, you know, from the moment that we're born. Usually, you know, they've done all kinds of experiments in the school system, and indeed, boys get called on 80% of the time in a mixed gender classroom, even when they're only, you know, 30 or 40% of the students. They get 80% of the teacher's time. They get called on using their first names. Girls are essentially "Hey, you." And look around at the stories that get told across movies and books. They're all male-identified and male-centered. And so to get any recognition at all at this point in history in this culture, you know, we live now in this media-dominated image-based culture. And for women, what that means is you have to look like a sex object or you get no attention at all. And getting attention as a sex object is not, in fact, any fun because you're an object, not a human being. So no matter what you do, it's a rock and a hard place. You're in a very classic double bind, which is what most oppressed people are put in one way or another. No matter what you do, you will be punished. You'll be invisibilized or you'll be violated in some way. And so there's not a good place to stand. And I think a lot of women just end up making the best personal decisions that they can for themselves because it doesn't seem like there's any way out. It seems so monolithic. And then they always point to the tokens. Well, she got ahead or she's the head of the CEO or whatever. And then, the rest of us feel like failures because, well, if she can make it work for her. But the whole system is rotten. That's the point, is that most women are never going to make it. It was not set up for us or by us, and it certainly isn't meant to give us control over the material conditions of our lives. So, that's what patriarchy is, and that's what it does. So I was born in 1964, so I'm 47, which means I'm the very last of baby boomers. 64 is the cutoff
point. Oh, okay, yeah.
So.
My sister was born in 65, you guys are at the very tail end of it. And I see some changes in the generation coming up too. But I wanted to mention this one thing: age discrimination definitely plays a part in this, along with the gender discrimination. And I really started to see this a lot after I became 40 years old. And let me be frank: if I was in an interview and the man was doing the interviewing, if I did not look like the sexual object or come off as the sexual object, I didn't get the job.
Right.
And usually if I had connections within that company, I would find out who did get the job. And it was the sexual object type of female, usually younger, extremely beautiful. And I thought, this is happening to me at the age of 40, and I thought, I better get into something that really, unfortunately, women do these particular positions and are normally stereotyped in these positions. And I went and got a healthcare license and started working in healthcare because I thought, if I don't, I'm going to end up not working. And so that's what I do now. But let's talk about trends in feminism. What's happening with the generations coming up? Do you think that they've just been totally brainwashed by the microblogging, media-centered and images that we see every day? And even know that anything is wrong, or is that just a certain select few?
I think a lot of them are really struggling because they've been told that feminism is essentially claiming your inner psycho slut, and then they try to act that out in the world, and in fact what they end up with is a lot of brutality, violation and violence, or at the very least personal relationships that are utterly unfulfilling. And a lot of this has to do with the overwhelming cultural bias toward the image now. People my age and your age, we grew up in a culture that was still based on the printed word. So, we handle information differently. Now, I don't even think we can understand what it's like to have grown up in this culture where the image is everything. And it's so overwhelming to the human brain, those images. It's not like the written word where you can, grapple with it and sort of accept it and reject it and, make meaning in your own head. The image is what it is. And the standard image of our culture is a young, thin, white, extremely thin, half-naked woman. And that's the cultural currency now. And most of us are never going to fit that. And even if we did, we shouldn't have to. It's the content of our characters. It's the fact that we have souls. It's not how well we fit this pornified image. But that is, in fact, what we are judged by. And so I think for a lot of young girls now, the culture has been so hypersexualized. I've seen this in even girls as young as 3 and 4. You tell them to, whatever it is, whatever fun thing it is you're doing. I remember from being a child when, we did little dances for my grandma. We were being sunflowers and swans. And the last time I hung out with my little cousins and I said, I thought dancing meant, ballerina type thing. I've never seen anything like this. It was just horrifying. It was like a stripper dance. And I'm talking about children who are 3 and 4 years old. And everybody I know has stories like that, where these little tiny children now have been utterly pornified and utterly sexualized, and it's all they know. And so I despair for the future of these girls. I mean, if they're already that broken from their own bodies and are already self-objectifying, I don't know what's going to happen when they're teenagers, or how they're going to survive out there in the world when they have to be adults. And this is completely about how the porn industry has just taken over the mainstream culture. It's a very disturbing trend, and it's not even just a trend. It's just massive amounts of power that have gone into this and money. But we're going to have to fight it, because there's not much hope for the next generation of girls that they don't find some way to reclaim some inner sense of self and learn to fight.
Do you think that the printed word made most of us from the older generation better able to critically think?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, there's no question about that. And study after study shows even what television does to children's brains, let alone all this computer stuff, and the speed now at which the images are coming at these children is just insane. And some of them, their exposure to media has not even just doubled or tripled, but it's like quadrupled or quintupled. And it's because they'll have 4 or 5 media images going at once. So they've got the computer, they've got the phone, they've got the iPad going, sometimes they've got a CD on, and they'll have all this media. The television's on in the other room. It's all coming at them at once. And they never learn to develop an interior world where, they can actually have, Congress with ideas and learn to have an imagination that will get them through the hard times. And this is why all over the world, when television is introduced into a culture and where it hasn't been there before and now it's finally reached, some remote place, the first thing that happens is the teen suicide rate, appears. Like they've never had teen suicide before. And all of a sudden, a couple years into this with the television, the children start committing suicide when they hit their teen years. And it's literally this lack of imagination. I mean, when I was growing up, I knew how to imagine. I was read really good books, and I loved reading. And when things got tough for me as a teenager, I could imagine myself into a different world. And maybe it was a future world that I could have for myself. Maybe it was a total fantasy world where, I had a sword and sorcery, kind of whatever. I mean, you could imagine something different. Maybe for some people it would be, I'm a great baseball player, or, I'm whatever, president. But whatever it is, you can imagine your way out. There's some world that you can create where you're okay and people love you. And for these kids, they can't do it anymore. They don't know how to imagine. It's like their brains have gone so passive from the media. And then the images that are put in there are just so horrifying that you can't really escape to them. Just more trauma. So what have they got? And so this is why I worry. I mean, they talk now about, the parents of this media generation, because the first ones now are having their own children, and they call it attachment deficit disorder, because they literally don't know how to nurture their own children. All they know how to do is gestural parenting. They don't know how to actually teach their children anything, like how to talk, how to behave. And it's really scary. If they can get in between that, I mean, what could be a more primary bond besides parent and child? And if this mass media corporate culture is able to break that bond, I don't know what hope there is for us as a species, frankly.
God, it's
and
almost
so,
like creating monsters. That's what's
it is.
Really scary.
Yeah. And one of my friends talks, sort of jokingly that it's just it's just zombies now. But yeah, it's a joke, and it's not, because it's fairly horrifying. And, the zombies are, they're sort of the ruling, kind of image now of, one part of pop culture. They're very... zombies and vampires. I don't actually think that that's a mistake. I think that a lot of these kids feel like zombies, and when they don't feel like zombies, they feel like vampires. And so that's, so much of the pop culture now is revolving around those two sort of fantastical creatures. I don't think that's a mistake.
Somebody passed a graphic around Facebook just recently, and it was, they were using the term after the zombie guy ate the guy's face off in Miami. It was like a big news story. But it said the zombie apocalypse or something like that, and it had a row of young people all on their cell phones, all texting. And
yes.
I thought, oh, my God, that's really creepy. I thought,
yeah.
That is a very, very unsettling image. And I thought, because that's what people are doing. That's exactly what they do. And that's how they're communicating. Everything is done through the cell phone. So like you said, if you're getting an image from TV and you're getting an image from the computer and you're getting an image from your cell phone and you're hearing the volume on the TV and then you've got a CD in, it's almost like you're being barraged with stimuli. I don't know how anybody could handle all that. I really don't. There's no way I could process all that.
I couldn't either.
So I prefer the printed word, as you do. I would rather much rather pick up a book. In fact, I really had to fight the whole thing about Kindle, and I thought, but, you know, when books were starting to go out of print, I thought, well, I really need to get a Kindle. And what really scares me about having a Kindle is that, you know, the minute a switch can be turned off, and then all this data gone, our books and everything. Like, you know, I have over 100 things on my Kindle, and I thought, if I don't have hard copy, hardcover, you know, books to keep, that's why I'm glad I had the Deep Green Resistance and an actual hardcover. I thought, there's a lot of things that I'd have on my Kindle that I'd lose forever. And that scares me, that possibility of the switch going off, which in a way would be good for a lot of people, but it would be bad in respect to the things that we would also lose. So so those are some things that I think about in regards to that. But let's talk about your thoughts on what most people don't want to talk about this, and I really think that it should be out there. Is, and you mentioned, you alluded to it just a little earlier about, pornography and how these young children are becoming sexualized. Let's talk about that for a little bit, because I don't think a lot of people are aware, or maybe they are aware and just don't want to admit that they know that pornography is rampant. That children are being used for it, that it's a billion-dollar business, billions and billions of dollar business, that with this particular business there are no borders, and this is going on unchecked everywhere. And how in the world are people going to stop this? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that I think most women don't want to know how bad it is, and it has gotten really horrendous. You know, in the 25 years that I've been involved in this, I don't think I ever thought it was going to get as bad as it has. Now, you know, you can just Google porn, and, you know, the first 10 things that come up will be absolutely just the worst misogyny you can imagine. Women called the most disgusting names, men doing just absolutely brutalizing, body-punishing sex to them. And this is seen as normal. You know, young kids now think it's perfectly normal to do these things to women, that women like it, that women want it, that women can take it. And as it turns out, the average woman now, the young woman who, you know, goes to Los Angeles and tries to join the porn industry, they only last maybe 3 months doing what's called gonzo porn. And that's because the sex itself is so violent that her body simply gives out. So they stitch them up and throw them on the street, and that's the end. That's the shelf life now of the average porn star, because the sex is just so horrible. So I think people need to see how bad this is. They really need to understand what's going on, and the fact that children of a younger and younger age are now being exposed to this. And this is not even just, you know, there's the objectification porn was bad enough, but we are seriously into the kind of, you know, pain and torture as absolutely normalized in sex. And just look at the names that the men call the women in these films, and, you know, in the gonzo stuff that's online. And if you've got anything like a heart or a conscience, you can't be anything but appalled. And to think that this is going on to the tune of $90 billion a year, that it's, you know, larger than the standard, you know, television and music industry combined, I mean, that's how much stuff men are consuming. And it's all of it just absolutely vile. So the culture is just being saturated now with the sadism. And this is why I fear for the next generation. And there are now children younger and younger age who are getting addicted to porn as well. I mean, the people who actually work, you know, the psychiatrists who deal with porn addiction talk now about 10-year-olds who are addicted to porn. They haven't even had sex yet, you know, hopefully. And they're already addicted to it, you know. And this is just, people need to understand how bad it is and how easy, it's because it's accessible and it's anonymous, so it's really easy for them to get a hold of it. And it just kicks right into those endorphin centers in your brain, and you get addicted to it just like any other drug. And then you don't even see the message that's being conveyed. You know, all you see is this highly stimulating image, and it just glosses right over what's actually being portrayed. And I've just had so many anecdotes about this. A friend of mine was protesting the war, and she had a big sign about, you know, the Iraq war, and you know, lots of men like to come over and argue with her just because they like to get into arguments with a woman. And, you know, immediately they wanted to talk about pornography. It was the funniest thing. The women, of course, didn't even occur to them, but men would immediately be like, well, you're here protesting First Amendment porn. It's like, it was just absolutely, that's where they went every time. And she would say things like, well, what about all the rape? And they'd say, there's no rape in porn. And she would say, it's all rape. And then they would get in a big fight, and, you know, they were clearly getting off on it, though, so she usually tried to bring it to a close pretty quickly. Well, what happened that was interesting was one guy came back the next day, and he was so upset, he was visibly shaking. And he said, you're right, it's all rape, but I never saw it. And that's it. That's what pornography does. You know, it shuts down the frontal lobes of your brain, and all the pleasure centers light up, and you literally can't think about what you're seeing. And images are like that anyway, but when you have something that's so highly stimulating, it's really hard to break through it. Now, in his case, he's lucky because all it took was one woman saying, you know what, it's called rape. And he was able to go back and look at it critically and not let his frontal lobes get shut off. And he saw what in fact had been there the whole time. And, you know, he still has enough of an inner self, of a core conscience, that he was able to go, holy hell, what have I been doing? Now, who knows whether he was transformed by this? You know, he may have gone back to just pretending it wasn't true. It may have affected him deeply. I don't know. We never heard from him again. But, I mean, I hear those kinds of stories all the time. And the other thing that's interesting is that there's on college campuses now, a lot of the people who work in health services will talk about these young guys who are coming in. They're 18, 19 years old, and they'll sign up for some kind of mental health counseling service. And it usually takes them 6 or 7, you know, sessions till they come out with the real problem. The problem is they're incredibly concerned about their porn usage. They can't actually have sex with a real woman. All they can have sex with is essentially their computers, and they're horrified by it. But they don't know who to talk to about it. They don't know what to say about it. All they know is that this is seriously wrong. They don't know how to be in a real relationship with an actual human being because they're so addicted to the images. And I've heard this now everywhere. I mean, it's happening everywhere. These counselors on college campuses are talking about this. So this is a whole generation now that's been pretty effectively destroyed and socialized into a level of sadism that is really horrifying. And I really urge people to take a look and don't let your frontal lobes get shut down. Really look at what you're saying.
And human trafficking, I know where you are in California and here in Florida where I am, we are two of the top states that actually this is happening. It's just happening all the time, and incredibly government agencies are involved, and our military is involved, and even our leaders, our elected leaders are involved. And I'm saying this very loosely now because after being in politics myself, people send me things. So right. I see a lot of things that normally people would not see. And the one picture, it was an image that was sent to me, was taken in Libya during the takeover last year. And it was, as we all know, there's dogs are sent in for bomb sniffing, and for NATO, I'm sure NATO troops use the dogs for, you know, not just security, but for bomb sniffing and lots of other purposes. But what I got was a picture of two naked children in a doggy crate. One only had underwear on. The other one had, they were locked up in the doggy crate. Now, this is an Arab country where most Arab countries do not have dogs as pets. In fact, the Quran really calls them, you know, disgusting animals, and they don't like dogs. And it's part of their religion and part of their culture not to like dogs. So the doggy crate, I assumed, only came from our side, from the military. I hate to say our side there.
Right. Our government side.
Government side. And these two children, with absolute fear and horror in their eyes, were locked in this doggy crate. And when that, when I saw the picture, I promptly went into the bathroom and threw up.
Yeah.
I just couldn't even, it took me like 5 minutes to get over that. And then I sent it on to a few other people that needed to see it to find out what was going on in Libya, and that were actually following what was happening there. And one of them was able to track down the actual photographer who took the picture so they could get more information. But this is going on a grand scale. And wherever we have troops, this is happening. And wherever we have contractors, this is happening. So this is much huger than most people even realize. And I'm probably going to start getting anonymous calls from DynaCorps again. Anonymous calls probably for a year and a half from DynaCorps, from the company DynaCorps. And they were calling me when I was in a very vulnerable situations and didn't have a lot of protection. And it was frightening, to say the least. But I'm telling the truth here. So I even think about the picture and just kind of get all emotional about it. So we'll move on to the vegetarian myth. And you have taken a lot of flack for writing this book from, I would say, the vegan, vegetarian community and people that were activists within the community. Can you explain why that book caused such an uproar and what you've done since with the information that was actually in that book?
I think the reason that it's so hard to just enter into dialogue about this subject, and I say this as someone who was a vegan for 20 years. Okay, I spent 20 years in that community, in that world, you know, inside that framework. So one thing is, nobody likes a heretic, nobody likes an apostate. So if I had left that world and just said, oh, it's all stupid, they might have ignored me. But I didn't. I left that world, and I laid claim to the same moral ground, but what I said was, we have some of the information wrong, and when you have full information, you might end up making a different decision. And that, a lot of them cannot bear, because there's a fundamentalist mindset that often comes, particularly with the vegans. In my experience, the vegetarians are a lot easier to talk with and have a more open dialogue, but a lot of the vegans, it's hard. And I say this as someone who is a fanatic. The world only changes because of fanatics. You have to have that, you know, single-pointed focus and that kind of passion, but we're not the easiest people to be around. We can be very, we can be ideologues. We can be very black and white in our thinking. And the thing about being a vegan is that it becomes your identity. It's not just what you eat. It's not just what you think. It becomes who you are. And that means that when someone comes at you with information that's threatening to your worldview, it's not just your worldview. It's your sense of self that feels like it's under assault. And I think that's the problem. So I wrote this book because I wanted the people who care the most about what's happening to the planet, and I really do think that's in large measure the vegans. I think that they really do have that kind of passion. But I wanted them to understand a bigger picture about where their food comes from and what it means. And that meant criticizing agriculture. It meant explaining what agriculture actually is, because that was not information that I had. When I made the decision to be a vegan, I thought I was doing the right thing. So I just want to reiterate that the values that underlie that vegetarian ethic are not the problem. So, you know, compassion and, you know, egalitarianism and anything that questions human hubris or human entitlement, I mean, those are really core values, and those are the really, really central to my life and to the world that we need. So that's not the issue. Like, we got that down. The problem simply is the information about what agriculture is. So, you know, the basic activity of agriculture is that you take a piece of land and then you clear all the life off of it, and really down to the bacteria. I mean, everything gets removed. And then you plant it to human use. So in doing that, you can destroy, in one season, you can destroy 2,000 years of topsoil. And topsoil is the basis of life, or life on the land anyway. And I mean, we owe our entire existence to 6 inches of soil and the fact that it rains. So by doing this, we've essentially stripped the planet. We've skinned the planet alive. So the first thing is mass extinction, because all those creatures and all those plants, they need a place to live. That's their home. And we take it away when we do agriculture. So they've got nowhere to go. At this point, we're losing 200 species a day. That's how many species are going extinct. It means that the human population grows really big, because instead of sharing that land with all those other creatures, you're only using that land for humans. So that's another big problem. Destroying the topsoil is not a plan with a future. There's no topsoil left, essentially, on the planet. We've pretty well blown through all of it. All the major grain-growing regions of the world are out of soil. And what we've been using instead since about 1950 is fossil fuel. So if you're eating grain, you're really eating oil on a stalk. That's where it comes from now, is a nitrogen fertilizer made from cheap oil and gas. And again, this is not a plan with the future, because we've hit peak oil. Okay, it might have been this year, it might have been 2 years ago. Whenever it was, it's now. And we are now on the downslope of that oil. Eventually we're going to run out, and then what will we eat? Those are some of the big problems with this. But really what it means is, if you think about places around the Mediterranean, around the Middle East, the Near East, those were all heavily forested at one point. I mean, Lebanon had cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. But if you call up an image of those places, what you see are these dry, rocky, barren, kind of landscapes. It's a human-created phenomenon, and it's agriculture that did it. So that's what happens when you strip away either the grasses or the trees, is that kind of clear cut of those ancient biotic communities. So we're on drawdown. Now we're on drawdown in a huge way. Agriculture has also been incredibly destructive to human health, to human society. It's the beginning of militarism. It's the beginning of slavery. We can talk about that if you want. But it's really been a fairly disastrous activity. And I just like to remind people that for our first 2.5 million years on this planet, we were not monsters. We were participants, like every other creature. We participated in soil-building activities. We were integrated into the land, and we took our sustenance from it, and we gave back in ways that were appropriate. It's really only been the last 10,000 years that we've become these sort of destructive, I don't even know what word to use. I don't want to say beasts, because animals are nice, but this sort of destructive phenomenon across the planet. And Lauren Cardane, who's a wonderful writer, he's an expert on Paleolithic nutrition, he uses a football field to bring this home. If our time on this planet is the entire length of that football field, it's only at the last half yard that agriculture begins. So that's where the disaster begins. It's just at that very last half yard of a football field. It's a tiny little bit of time. We don't have to do this to our planet. So to me, it's actually kind of hopeful, because it's not that hard for us to remember a better way. And indeed, there are still people here who have not lost their way. But for most of the human race right now, we are dependent on agriculture. And so that's one of the big problems that I try to address in my work and in my writing and in my activism.
Basically, humankind has participated in the desertification of huge swaths of land all over the planet.
Yes.
Really, that's happened. And
yes.
As one of the activists and definitely trying to increase awareness about, the aftermath of the Gulf oil spill, I've run across many, many people that will try to disclaim the peak oil theory. What do you say to people that say that we have tons of oil, it's abiotic oil, there's plenty of it? And what do you say to that? And who do you quote when you're trying to present these people with the scientific facts that, no, we've reached peak oil and we are past the bell curve on that?
Richard Heinberg, I think, is the best writer. He's a really good, he's a good place to start, and he's very accessible. And, you know, it's meant for the lay public. It's not just meant for scientists. So I always tell people to read Richard Hindberg, either The Party's Over or Peak Everything. Some of these people you can't argue with because, honestly, it's theology for them. You know, they just believe in human entitlement to a level that's completely insane. And I can't get through to them. Maybe somebody else could, but I just don't know how. But, you know, oil, it doesn't reproduce. I mean, it's, you
right.
know, they don't. But the little drops of oil don't get a birds and bees talk from the big drops of oil. Like, there's, it's, once it's gone, it's gone. I mean, it's, if it's now or if it's in 20 years, it doesn't matter. It's, there will be a day when it costs too much to get it out of the ground. You know, it used to be for every calorie we put in, we got 100 out. That was, the living was easy. You know, that was the low-hanging fruit. All of that oil is gone. It's taking more and more energy now to get it. And, you know, they're so desperate on a global scale that they've done crazy stuff like the tar sands. You know, which if you include all of the energy inputs, it might not even be a net gain. So it's pretty insane the level to which this society will go to keep up its sense of, I don't even know what, denial, you know, underneath which is a kind of psychopathic entitlement, I think. We
yeah,
don't have
that's
the right
what
to destroy
I would
the
call
planet.
It denial and slash entitlement, it seems to
yeah.
be. And it's really amazing that people are afraid to use the words ecocide and terricide and genocide when speaking about, for instance, the Gulf oil spill. I don't
right.
see it as any other way. But yet people won't even say those words or admit that that's what occurred. And, of course, the Gulf oil spill affects me directly because I live here, you know, I'm in the Gulf region. But this is happening in other places around the planet, too, that we don't even hear about. So
yeah,
it's almost
yeah.
these oil companies have become their own nations as far as their money goes, their resources go, and they can do these things with impunity, and they just continue to do them. So it's basically the same as the nuclear reactors and everything else. So I guess we can just go on to the book that changed my life. Oh, I did want to mention before we go into this other book was I watched your video many, many times over and passed your video around of what you spoke about. It was in November of last year at Occupy, I think it was Oakland.
Yes, correct.
And you gave like a 10 or 11 minute speech about exactly where we were at environmentally to the Occupy people at that particular event. And it was frightening. So anybody out there who's listening, I would encourage you to go and watch that video and pass it around. If you go to YouTube and look up Lierre Keith, Occupy Oakland, November 2011, you'll find that video. Do you remember which one I'm speaking about?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I'm really pleased that you liked it so much. It's really hard to get that much information into 10 minutes. And it's even harder to get it over a bullhorn because they didn't have a sound system. So, it was a tough call. But I actually had that speech sitting right in front of me. Yeah, I went through three things, civilization, capitalism, and patriarchy, and how all three of them are, you know, they're interlocking systems at this point that work as a feedback loop on each other. And they just accelerants on this process of destruction. And it is really frightening. There's we need a real resistance movement. There's nothing else that can be said. The planet's just being murdered before our eyes. So if we don't fight, it's over. I mean, that's really, I think, the bottom line. This is it. This is the last moment to stand up for the planet.
So we will, with that, we'll segue into this next book. Actually, it was written by three authors. Lierre Keith was one of them. Derek Jensen and Eric McBay were the other two, and it was called Deep Green Resistance. And I bought this book after I heard Derek Jensen on a radio show. In fact, I don't think the book had been published yet, but I wrote it down on my list of books to get. And I knew that it was going to be a book that I wanted to get in the printed word and not on Kindle and not on my computer. So I went and purchased this book because it wasn't available on Kindle at that time. And it changed my life. So I encourage anybody that's out there listening to definitely check out this book. So tell our listeners exactly what deep green resistance is.
Well, the first part of the book is just describing the problem. So what is civilization, and why is it inherently unsustainable? And I've already touched on agriculture, but ultimately it just means people living in densities such that they require the importation of resources. So they're living in cities or large towns, and it means that they've used up the resources that are on the actual land where they live. And so things like water and food and energy, they all have to come from somewhere else. And so from that point forward, it doesn't actually matter what kinds of lovely nonviolent values people might hold in their hearts, because that society is now dependent on imperialism and genocide. Since they've used up their own resources, they've got to go out and get them from somewhere else. And nobody else willingly gives up their land or their soil or their trees or their fish or whatever. And that's really, you know, what's been going on for the last 10,000 years is simply that process of, you know, the civilization arises and it conquers the surrounding region, and then the whole thing collapses because eventually they use up everything. And civilizations last as long as their topsoil, which is anywhere from 800 to about 1,500 years, and then it collapses. The problem now, of course, is that fossil fuel has added a whole other level of acceleration to this, and the whole thing's gone global. But ultimately, it's the same boom and bust cycle. It won't go on forever. So everything is going down with us. And some of the really scary facts about the situation, you know, like a lot of scientists right now are debating whether a quarter, a third, or fully half of all mammals will be extinct by the year 2050. So half the mammals on the planet are going to be gone. And in fact, there's some people who are wondering whether the planet will support life at all by the end of this century. So, you know, what does that give us, 88 years? And that's it, that the planet will simply be too hot, too dry, and the weather patterns too disrupted at that point, and it just won't support life. There may be some bacteria at, you know, the thermophilic bacteria at the vents at the bottom of the ocean. I do not consider that a success, okay? I really want something to continue. Okay, so that's civilization. Then you have to add capitalism, which takes living creatures in their homes, and it says they're private property, and then it turns them into dead commodities, and then those get accumulated into wealth. This last part, particularly accumulating them into wealth, that's brand new in the history of the human race. It's really barely 300 years old, capitalism. They like to make us all think that there is no other way, that there is no other alternative. But for vast amounts of our time on this planet, until the last 300 years, that's out of 2.3 million, nobody thought about this as a way to conduct ourselves. It's kind of a crazy system because it's all about accumulating more wealth. And so what that means is the people who have the capital are always looking for more opportunities to reinvest it and make more profit. And they can only do that if consuming is constantly increasing. In fact, if the economy doesn't grow by about 3% every year, it collapses. This is insane because the planet is finite, and you cannot have infinite growth on a finite planet. And that is what capitalism says we have to do, and that's how it's set up everybody's economic activities. And the end point is obvious to anyone who can think, you know, ahead even a century. It's eventually we will use it all up. It's kind of a no-brainer. So that's capitalism. And then we talk about patriarchy as well and entitlement and how that's eroticized under patriarchy, how there's this male violation imperative that boys get socialized into. And so that violation includes, you know, violating women and girls. It includes violating, you know, the physical boundaries of forests and rivers and grasslands. It means violating the boundaries of the atom itself, violating the DNA of other creatures. So we've got things like transgenic salmon now in the pipeline. And all of that is based on this idea that violating is somehow what makes men into real men. So all three of these systems work together to create this, you know, essentially a perfect storm of genocide and gynocide and ultimately biocide, and the planet's going down. So that's sort of the diagnosis, and we spend the first half of the book going over that. We throw in a couple more concepts that your listeners might find interesting. We talk about the distinction between liberals and radicals, which a lot of people do find helpful. And I would say that the main distinction is that radicals understand that that society is made up of material institutions, and that mm-hmm. those institutions are formed by groups of people who have power over other groups of people. So it's not about individuals. It's about groups and classes, and some have power over others, and that's very material. Whereas for liberals, society is only made up of individuals. It's not about groups. And if you identify somebody as a member of a group, that's supposed to be the insult. And further, reality is more or less a mental event. So society is made up of ideas. So mental constructs and frameworks and, you know, the paradigm shift, that's all very liberal. And so what it comes down to is that liberals think that the best way to change the society is to affect people's consciousness, and only that. So their best strategy is always to educate. And for radicals, it's really different, because once you see that it's about groups having power over other groups, you realize that, you know, it's going to take a group effort to overthrow those power structures, and that materially they do have to change, that power is not a mistake, it's not a misunderstanding, that we're not going to convince the powerful to give up their power. It's not going to happen by personal transformation or by spiritual epiphany. It happens by force, because they don't give up all their entitlement and the entitled psychology that goes with that. So it really happens when you take some kind of a bite out of an institution, or you bring it down completely, and then you can rearrange the material conditions more toward justice so that people can actually control their lives and have a say over what's happening to them. And right now, most people on the planet simply don't have that. So that's the main distinction between liberals and radicals. So from there, we move on and talk about, okay, the exact situation that we are in terms of, you know, the planetary crisis. And, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but around the planet right now, the plankton populations are collapsing. You know, plankton are those little green things that I don't think most people ever think about, but they're unable to survive now because the oceans have become so acidic, and that's from all the carbon. The oceans do act as a carbon sink, but they're overloaded now. They can't take any more. And so the plankton are collapsing. And 2 out of 3 animal breaths are made possible because of the oxygen that the plankton produce, which is to say if the oceans go down, we go down with them. And around the world, you can look at it, every biological indicator is headed in the wrong direction. Not only that, at an ever-increasing rate, everything is collapsing. We have not even slowed the rate of destruction, and that's after 50 years of having an environmental movement. So we took a look at all this and said, okay, what will it take? So what are the worst offenders right now? What are the things that are absolutely pushing the planet to the brink of destruction? And, you know, burning fossil fuel is absolutely one of the worst things that's happening, probably the worst. That's what's going to create the emergency faster than anything else. It's already creating, you know, really disrupted weather. It's finally come to this country, right? I think most of the interior of the continent was pretty much on fire for the last 2 months. It's pretty frightening to watch. But the only good thing
and
is
last
that,
year it was flooding. If
yeah,
you remember,
I know.
It was all along that line and everything last year. So now they have the fires, and this is just. And here we've had some unseasonal, what we're getting right now are the rains in the afternoon that we used to get, that we haven't had for a number of years. So actually we would always have an afternoon thunderstorm that would actually cool everything off in the very hot part of the day. But it has steadily, I've been here in Florida off and on since 1968, and it's been getting hotter and hotter and hotter every summer. It's almost to the point where we used to have a winter that was more like a spring up north. We don't even have that anymore. So it's really, the weather has definitely changed, but I've been very, very happy for the afternoon rains, because that's the only way that even living here is tolerable anymore. You mentioned all these different things, all these different processes, these things that are happening with the environment and with force and with giving up trees and water and land. Everything that you mentioned brings us back to one thing, which is war. This is how those in power, they smash and grab. And it's at the end of guns. That's exactly what it is. They want those things. They're going to go out and get those things. So if it's not water, if it's not property, if it's not money or gold, you know, it's something else. It really doesn't matter what it is. It's going to be acquired by the end of a gun. And those ones in power are going to take those things. So we are at the first hour point of the show. Did you want to keep going and talk a little bit about what we need to do now? Now that we know what the problem is, what do we need to do to fight back?
I can go a little bit longer, and then I will be worn out. So, but I would like to talk about resistance before we end, because this is really the important point. I think that if our country had been taken over by, you know, fill in the blank with evil fascist, Nazi, whatever, and they were, you know, drawing down the water, destroying the soil, sending 200 species every day into extinction. If they were, you know, murdering the Gulf of Mexico and taking all the trees and, you know, destroying the bison and all the things that have happened on North America, in North America. So if it was outside invaders who came in and did this, I think we would know that it was time to fight back. And the problem is that we're so entitled that because we're really at the top of the heap here, globally speaking, right? And so people either feel that kind of entitlement, or I think the people who are awake to it are in too much despair, especially given that all of the major environmental organizations, none of them are telling the truth. They're not telling the truth about how bad the situation is, and even when they do on occasion go ahead and tell the truth, they don't give us solutions that in any way match the scale of the problem. So what we're told over and over is buy this instead of that, essentially. And it's insane. That's not going to stop those in power. Let's pretend that we were, you know, in the resistance in Europe during the Nazi era. I don't think anybody would suggest riding bikes and buying organic shampoo and composting our kitchen scraps would have been, you know, an appropriate response to living under Nazi occupation. Well, we are living under occupation, and people need to understand that. We're living under the occupation of that global corporate civilization, that model, and our planet is being destroyed before our eyes. So it is time to fight back. So if we pretend that we are, you know, that the evil people came from the outside and are doing this to us, it becomes clear that we need to fight back. So the two models that I like to use when I'm talking about, well, what does this mean, fight back? There's different strategies about how people have formed social movements that have been effective, and, you know, many movements have chosen nonviolence and other movements have not. And I actually don't have a particularly moral position on which is the right thing to do. I simply want to be effective. And I say that because of the desperation. If we had all the time in the world, I would only be suggesting nonviolence, because I think it's a very elegant technique, and I hate what violence does to people. You know, it creates trauma over generations. We all know this.
Right.
But we're out of time. And the thing about nonviolence is that you don't use weapons, you use your bodies, but it takes many, many people and a huge level of commitment. And my problem is I don't see the numbers. I would really, really love to be wrong, because I would give anything to wage the struggle nonviolently, but I just don't see that many people are going to rise up and do this. So the historical precedent for this is actually 2010, the labor strike in France. And this is when all those austerity measures were being suggested in France. And, you know, they still have a real left in Europe, unlike in the United States. And they know how to fight back when, you know, when their basic rights are being threatened. They have a real labor movement. So the austerity measures are being suggested, and they went on a nationwide strike for a month. And they know how to think strategically. So they went for the oil terminals, and they used human blockades, and they stopped the oil from coming into the country. There were, I think, 32 oil tankers that were stranded in the Mediterranean because they couldn't offload. And none of the trucks could come into the terminals and take the oil out. So they completely blockaded the whole oil infrastructure. And indeed, within a few weeks, the economy was on the verge of collapse. So the French government had to open the emergency reserves, and then the people went and blockaded those as well. But it takes thousands and thousands and thousands of people to do this day after day after day. Now, in the end, the strike was broken, which is too bad. But you see what can be done. And if we had a million people who were willing to do this, who would go and stand in solidarity with the mountains of Appalachia and stop the mountaintop removal. There's literally one train line, there's one rail line out of parts of Appalachia. All they'd have to do would be shut that down. Such a small group of people is all it would take. To do that nonviolently, it could be done. But people aren't thinking in those terms anymore. It's all they can think about is either symbolic action or action that's about sort of personal lifestyle choices, which, again, are never going to reach the scale that we need to achieve if we're actually going to save our planet. So, you know, stop the tar sands, the pipelines for the tar sands, the oil refineries, and all of that horrible coal stuff that's coming out of Appalachia, all of that could be shut down very quickly using nonviolence. The question is, do we have the people? And I'm not sure that we do. I wish that we did. I wish that people could feel the emergency of 200 species every day and, you know, the end of life by the end of the century, but I just don't see that kind of mass uprising. And that frightens me, that we are that passive in the face of just, you know, utter biocide. So the other model that I talk about in the book is MEND, and that's the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. Now, again, this is a group of people, the Ogoni people mostly, who lived, used to live in the world's largest wetland, which is the Niger Delta, and the place has been absolutely devastated by the oil industry. Oil is Nigeria's number one, you know, money-making venture, and, of course, all it means is that that top 1% have been enriched to a level that is obscene, and the people who actually live there have been devastated. They're knee-deep in oil sludge, literally. I mean, it's just there's nothing left. They're all sick and starving because the land and the water has been destroyed, so they used to be self-sufficient, and there's nothing left. It's all just, you know, under this sludge. So the first-generation resistance was led by Ken Sarawiwa, who was a poet and an activist and very much believed in nonviolence. And there were many, many different protests that they did to try to stop the destruction of their land. And in the end, they were all hanged by the military government. And, you know, people should know that the oil industry, many of the oil companies actually have private militaries that they send around the world. I mean, they see themselves as countries unto themselves. Anyway, the private military, at that point, Nigeria had been was taken over by a military junta. So anyway, all of this together, these people were just simply murdered, and that pretty well destroyed their resistance for a while. So there are still people trying to do the nonviolent part, and I think that's very commendable after what they've been through. But there's another group now that's arisen, and their name is MEND. And it's not that I agree with everything they've done, but just listen to what they have done, because it's very amazing. They use speedboats, and they use they do coordinated attacks against the infrastructure of the oil industry. So they go after pipelines and bridges and terminals and all the different support vessels and all the things that make oil actually happen. And they have been so successful that they have permanently stopped 30% of the oil from even being pumped from the ground. Some of the companies have left Nigeria because they simply can't do it anymore with MEND on the patrol. And there was a series of attacks about a year and a half ago where in 1 week they stopped 80% of the oil, of Nigeria's oil, 80%. And the thing about MEND is there's only 300 of these people. There's not even like 3,000. Literally a few hundred people were able to stop 80% of the oil. And that's the thing. I mean, this is why people take up these kinds of techniques and tactics. It's scary to consider, but I think we need to consider it. If we don't have the numbers to do this nonviolently, which one more time I would prefer above all other options, what are we going to do? And this is an option I think people should at least be talking about. In other countries, you know, when people have, you know, the boot of the man is on their throats and just literally committing genocide across their land, they know what it means to fight back and they do what has to be done. In this country, I just don't know whether we're going to love our land to that extent. It may be that since we all get our food from the grocery store, we don't notice that our land is being destroyed like that, but it is. I mean, the Gulf Coast has just been devastated in this exact same process of what's happened to the people in Nigeria. Certainly Appalachia is just being leveled for the coal.
Did you have some expectations of the Occupy movement actually coming up and facing some of these situations in our country head on, or have you kind of lost the expectations of them as a unified group actually doing environmental activism such as this, direct actions, in other words?
I think a lot of the Occupy people have that kind of passion, and it's really wonderful to see an upswell of any kind of protest against the status quo because things are so bad. So I think a lot of us were really excited when it got started, and I think a lot of the people involved are really great. I think the problem with the Occupy movement is that it seems that the culture of Occupy is very much opposed to having a plan. you know, they don't want to have demands, and they don't want to make a program about how we're going to get from A to B. And without a series of demands and then, you know, some kind of a strategic plan about, you know, the road forward, we will not ever get there. It's not just going to happen spontaneously. You know, they need to actually take on some of the structures of power and make a dent. I mean, that's how movements work, is brick by brick, you know, you knock it down. And so to me, it feels sort of like a moment that may be squandered, because this really should have been the new populism. Just even economically, people were hurting so bad that, you know, and they have the wonderful slogan about the 1% and the 99%. That caught for a reason. People got that, you know, so they had this wonderful sort of, you know, instantaneously graspable metaphor about how bad things were. And, you know, I was sort of hoping they would extend it to the natural world, because the statistics are exactly the same. I mean, literally 98% of the old growth forests are gone and 99% of the world's prairies are gone. So it's the same statistic. You know, it's still, whichever way you look at it, you know, it's those of us on the bottom are being wiped out. But I think that the culture of Occupy has made them, it's going to make them irrelevant if they don't sort of change their ways about this, because we're not going to get from A to B without having an organization that has some demands and actually has a strategic plan about getting there. And I'm just afraid that there's kind of an anarchist sort of, you know, overlay to the culture of Occupy that really is against any kind of organization and refuses to have a plan. So I'm hoping that some of it turns around, but as it stands now, I'm just afraid they're going to end up I don't know. I just hope it's not a squandered moment, because I think there was a lot of promise there. There was a lot of anger about what the banks had done and the financiers had done. And that's a good place for people to start. It's a really good place. It can be extended from there. You know, people can get more radicalized. But I'm afraid that they might blow it, and that's kind of a sad thing, because it's one of the best things that's happened in a while. I guess you were involved with Occupy where you are in Florida?
I was involved a little bit with the Occupy Tampa, and I'm still in touch with some of the people, but I think the economic situation is so bad here that people couldn't devote many, many hours to it, and people had to go and get real jobs and go to work and things like that. So it was very, it was like you. I was very excited in the very beginning, and I was, in fact, I remember when I realized that when I first heard there was an encampment in Tampa, I was just, because I was already watching what was happening in New York and everywhere else.
Right.
And when I heard what was happening in Tampa, not far from here, I was actually dancing around the house and I was singing songs like Revolution is so much fun. And I was just completely ecstatic that it was, that it had reached here. Which is
right.
Very, very, this area is quite conservative in a lot of respects. And we do have the snowbirds during part of the year, and most
sure,
of them
sure.
come down from up north, and they're very conservative. So I was really happy, and like you, I really had some expectations of things happening by now, but they haven't. So like you said, if it's not a squandered moment and they kind of loop it all back around and put it all back together, I'm still in a big support of what they're doing. I mean, there's no question there. I wanted to look at some of the points just very quickly from the one of the last chapters in the Deep Green Resistance book, which it was appropriately named Our Best Hope, written by you, and it had six very important points. So after reading all this stuff in the beginning of the book and kind of losing hope, this chapter at the end, towards the end, really uplifted me quite a bit. But I'll read those points real quickly. Number one, Deep Green Resistance recognizes that this culture is insane. Okay, we all know that. Number two, Deep Green Resistance embraces the necessity of political struggle. Number three, Deep Green Resistance must be multi-level. Four, Deep Green Resistance requires repair of the planet. And Deep Green Resistance means repair of human cultures, which we must have that for anything to work. And Deep Green Resistance recognizes the necessity of militant action. Now, reading this, some people would say, oh, this group is into violence, and they want to accomplish what they want to do through violent means. What would you say to some of those people that would actually categorize deep green resistance as a violent movement?
Well, I would say that the dominant culture is violence personified. You know, battering is the number one, you know, the most broadly committed violent crime in the United States right now, and that's a man beating up a woman. And
right. That's
it. That's number one. You know, every 18 seconds a man does that. Look around the globe. Look what's happening. You know, the only reason we're not aware of the violence that goes into, you know, every single consumer good that essentially that we have is because we live behind a military barricade, so we don't have to see it. But the violence is happening to people who are poor and generally have brown skin, so they don't count as human. We don't see them. We don't hear about the violence. But every day, violence is being done to them. They're being driven off their land, or their land is being destroyed as they watch, so that we can have stupid things like cell phones. It's not even like we're doing it for food. We're doing it for, like, the most ridiculous, you know, fluffy consumer crap. And that's what's happening around the world. So the violence is already there. We're just trying to stop the violence, is what I would say, because it's unjust and it's wrong. And, you know, it's also destroying the living planet that is our only home. So I would flip it around. You know, that's, we're not the ones who are doing the violence. We're the ones who are trying to stop the violence, because the system is, you know, simply violence personified. And we do have to bring an end to that and bring justice back into the picture if we have any chance of survival.
And for those of you out there that will say that slavery ended in 1865, you need to read this book, Deep Green Resistance, because slavery never did end. It's been called by other names, but it's still very, very much in existence and still a system that actually brings to us the products that we use every day, like you mentioned, Lear, about, you know, the lithium and things like that that go into just our cell phones or our laptops or whatever. These are conflict minerals and chemicals and things like that, and elements that wars are fought over, and genocide is committed on these people that live around these areas where these things are mined or acquired, acquired through violence. So with that said, did you have any parting words for our listeners in regards to what your next plans are or your next book?
I'm currently
where you'll be.
Book. Yeah, go ahead.
Or where you'll be speaking next?
My next big speaking engagement is actually on September 14th, and it's at in Vermont, in Montpelier, which is the state capital. There's a fabulous group of people they call themselves the Second Vermont Republic, because Vermont was actually an independent republic before it joined the United States, and their goal is to make Vermont an independent republic once more. So they're trying to secede from the United States. And they're a fantastic group of people, and they mean business, and it's really fun. And so they've invited me to come and speak at their, they have a congress every year where all the secessionists get together and plot and plan, and I'm going to be speaking there, and I'm really looking forward to it. I think this is, and they get so much of this picture. They get empire, they get globalization, they get corporate control, they get how much violence is involved, they get that oil is destroying the planet, that global warming is here, and they're doing their best to make the beast fall apart, and they want to secede, and I think they're going to do it. I think that there's all hope now is on Vermont, as far as I'm concerned. Vermont is an interesting place because a lot of it is still run by town meeting. It's small enough that they can still make local decisions face-to-face with neighbors, and so they have that as their history and as sort of part of the culture of Vermont is very much about direct democracy. So it doesn't surprise me that this comes out of Vermont. But anyway, it's a great group. They've got two radio stations and a newspaper. They've run candidates already for governor and for state senate, all on the secessionist platform. And this just gives me tremendous hope. So I'm going to be speaking there on September 14th. If anybody is in New England, you can come and hear me do my best to give a rousing call to revolution in the state of Vermont. And then I'm writing a book about prairies, and the reason that prairies are important is they build topsoil at an incredible rate, and perennial grasses are just astounding creatures. And the basic building block of soil is actually carbon. So this is one of the only things that I find hope in, is that here's a great statistic. If we were to take even 75% of the world's trashed out grasslands, and they've all been pretty well trashed by agriculture, but even 75% of them, and we could restore them to the grasslands that they really want to be, within 15 years, more or less, we could sequester all of the carbon that's been released since the beginning of the industrial age. So we would be well below 350 parts per million. And all we have to do is let the grass come home. That's all we have to do. All we have to do is stop destroying, and the planet will fix it. It's not too late. And so this is why I'm writing this book, is because soon it will be too late. But I think that it's still possible. So that's what we have to do, is bring the grass back. So that's why I'm writing a book about prairies. I want people to understand that this is, as far as I can tell, the only thing that's going to work. I mean, none of the high-tech solutions are going to do anything. They just they're really terrifying that they want to try to do things like, you know, geoengineering and whatnot. I just think that's a nightmare in the making. But the grasses, yes, the grasses could come home, and they would fix it. So that's why I'm writing about prairies.
And are you going to be doing any more collaborative efforts with Derek Jensen, Eric McBay, or any other authors? Do you have any plans in the works for that?
Well, I just had a book that came out that I edited, and it's called The Derek Jensen Reader. So it's sort of the best of Derek Jensen. So if anybody, you know, if you want to give somebody a present to get them excited about Derek's work, my name is on it and his name is on it, and that was fun. Currently, I don't have any particular plans to do anything collaborative, but I'm not opposed to it at all. I think it can be very fruitful to work with other writers when you share similar passions. It's a multiplier effect on each other. So, and I had a lot of fun writing Deep Green Resistance with the two of them. So it will probably happen again.
Oh, good, good. That's good to hear. Well, we'll just go ahead and close, and I wanted to thank you so much for being on the show. And I did see, by the way, the Derek Jensen Reader on, I think it is available on Kindle, but I did see it on Amazon a little earlier when I was looking that up. So comes highly recommended. But I would love to have you on the show again, and maybe we can pick just one topic next time instead of all of these topics that you're so passionate about. That way we can focus on maybe patriarchy or maybe you'll have a lot to tell us about, you know, secessionism next time.
Right. Yes.
I mean, that'll be interesting, and I have a feeling that once they get this going up in Vermont, there's going to be a lot of people wanting to move there.
So that's
interesting to think about, and maybe it would cause other states to actually look at that possibility too. So there's hope. I really do believe that there's hope, just like that last one of those last chapters in Deep Green Resistance. And I'm glad that you were able to write that chapter, because it would have been very difficult to think about hope reading through the very beginning of the book, because it really hits you hard with what's happening on our planet right now. And I just really hope that everybody that's listening does pick up that book and read it from cover to cover, because it did change my life. But thank you so much, and we will be in touch, and I will send you the link for the archive, and you can pass that around. But thanks so much for being on the show. It's definitely appreciated.
Well,
and,
thank you.
Yeah,
thank you
and have a wonderful
all your kind
evening.
Words. Okay,
and
you
please,
too.
Yeah, please get in touch with us with about any updates once you do the speaking engagement in Vermont.
Okay,
thanks. All right, everybody, have a great night. And thank you for being on the Wise Women Media Radio Show. Bye-bye.
That isn't just the sound of the all-new 2016 Mercedes-Benz GLC being put through its paces. It's the sound of innovation. The innovation behind one of the most advanced SUVs on the road today. With multiple driving modes, a suite of intelligent drive systems, and a technology-filled cabin that sets new standards in modern luxury. This is what innovation sounds like. Now, discover what it feels like in a 2016 Mercedes-Benz GLC.
Some equipment described as optional.